Hello, all you young whippersnappers. My name's Malloy, and if you whet my whistle, I'd see my way to telling a story. No, not the one about the Mothman. This is a horse of a different color. About a strange concern fold in the air that turned out to be a door to another world. Now pull yourselves up a stool, and I'll tell you about these fellers named Greg and Toby, asking me all about this here New Century multiverse, after they took a trip through the wind dome. Hello, listeners, and welcome to part two of our first episode discussing secret rooms. Part of me wants to stop dividing our episodes into two parts, especially when this episode was already supposed to be a discussion of what is literally part one of the novel, titled Beginnings. Which means that I'm technically introducing part two of part one, and that just feels way too confusing. That said, the edit for this specific episode took extra long, even with me working on it every day, and if we are delivering shorter episodes every week, that not only means less crunch for me, but also more content for you, quicker, and in more digestible bites. So we'll handle each future episode on a case-by-case basis. We now return you to the original Skype conversation, already in progress. Let's see here. We've talked already a little bit about some of the experience of toxic fathers, mostly focusing on Mr. Penrose. But, you know, as we continue on into chapters 2 and 3, we have examples with the father of young Tom Sweeney, who is going around and telling his son that no means maybe and maybe means yes. The second he said that, I would be punching him in the face.
Abigail's just hammering that right trigger button.
Yeah, exactly. Why doesn't the renegade trigger go off? Also, later on, during story time in Weirwood, and young Doris Cooper is espousing anti-black sentiments as being the reason for the everything that's going on right now. Everything wrong that's going on right now. And, you know, that's already, like, the thing people say whenever anything is going wrong, or even when the slightest thing is going wrong, it's always the fault of people that are not white. So, it's just, yeah, exactly.
Excuse me, I'm just going to get more and more exasperated with each, So... All right, I'll stop there.
It'll be an ongoing thing, absolutely. As we were trying to remember the sequence of events of Secret Rooms, we sidetracked onto an aspect of its construction. We did get into it in the original conversation, but I edited that down to be more concise and include things I didn't think of at the time. For those of you whose only experience of New Century is Let Them Go, you may notice that the framing device for the telling of Secret Rooms is different. Let Them Go was straight-up third-person. Typically in this kind of narrative voice, the narrator is not a character in the story. They often know things that the characters in the story don't know, such as what people are thinking or various plot points, before the characters become aware of them. In this story, and a number of the others of New Century, the characters are using a variant of this voice. With only a few exceptions, the story is told through journal entries. This is referenced in both Secret Rooms and Cartographer's Handbook, that one of the requirements of soldiers in the reunified states of America is to keep a regular journal. The conceit here is that during a time of upheaval, when no one knows how long anyone has, they want to make sure that important information doesn't get lost because people died. This does also mean that a lot of information that might not be essential to survival gets written down, but given the usefulness of journaling in the case of therapy, It does also feel like writing these entries would be a stabilizing force in a chaotic world, therefore useful above and beyond the purpose that the cartographers put them to. As far as the story is concerned, this affords interesting narrative tools. Instead of an omniscient narrator, each character's significance is able to relate directly to the audience what they know, how they feel about events, and how those things differ from character to character. And in at least one part of these early chapters, it means that because the journal writer knows someone else will read this, that they will sometimes directly address the reader. As far as the writer is concerned, the reader is another character in this story. As far as we, the audience, are concerned, they are dropping character and directly addressing us. This is what brings us back to the original conversation about toxic values passed from parent to child, in the case of Doris Cooper. Because here Abigail Gray alludes to events we have not yet witnessed, and implies that this grim exchange with Doris is not the end of her story. Here, Abigail herself gets to play omniscient narrator.
I'd like to tell you that over time Doris became a good person, put aside the things she'd been told and made up her own mind about the world. I'd like to tell you that.
But I don't remember.
But this is not, Shawshank ain't no fairy tale world.
Yeah.
And now for something completely different.
One of the majorly significant moments of these first five chapters is after the decision has been made to send a bunch of children from Clearwater to Weirwood, as Abigail is on the cart, she is having her own flashback to that moment where her mother and father put her on the cart, and she is remembering the way that her mother dressed and put red lipstick on, and then the experience of Abigail with her father, where, she's reading his face and seeing something there that she's never seen before, but instead of exchanging of words or trying to provide a last little bit of wisdom, the moment that we get is Hector Gray placing the thing that would become Abigail's totem, his Stetson, onto her head. And that's already invoking Last Crusade there a little bit, even though in that particular story, the Hat of Power that was given to Indy was not by his father. For those of you who have not seen Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, the fedora that we view as iconic to Indiana Jones was a gift from a nameless bandit that admired Indy's grit and bravery. That kind of encounter has been homaged in many other pieces of fiction, including one of my favorites, the Uncharted video game series. In this case, though, Alex is practically doing it better. Here it is directly a gift from father to daughter, and it is Hector's way of showing that he has trust in Abigail to be someone that can act in his stead, in a way that you would usually only expect a father to entrust to son. You can't help but feel like, you know, this is almost her induction here into becoming a full-fledged protagonist slash heroine, is the imbuing of the Hat of Power on her. The reason why this particular scene felt so important, like, it was one that I remembered even prior to going back over it. I wanted to highlight the significance of Alex's ability to express visual language in text. His preferred medium is movies. Long-term fans of School of Movies know the reasons behind his favoritism. A well-done movie gets a story told within a couple of hours and brings together storytelling through visuals, script, music, and good editing. It's a minimal investment of time, and the good ones are not only a joy to partake of, but often have many layers that can be analyzed through rewatch and conversation. Now take TV and video games. While they also have multiple mediums of exploring narrative, they take much longer to get through, and often have filler that doesn't really add to the story, either due to needing to meet a certain runtime or play length. Books, meanwhile, may have a small time investment, but can only tell a story through words. When he is building his story inside New Century, which was first and foremost meant to be a series of books, and only later did he decide to go on and try to add further texture to it by getting a bunch of people he knew and friends to make this into an audio drama, and then continuing to work the special editing magic that he has to include, you know, sounds and music and all the other stuff that he does with his editing wizardry in order to make this as vibrant and immersive as possible. It doesn't change the fact that he still needed to be able to describe scenes, which in the case of movies, you could do potentially without any dialogue at all. It's all about the talent of the people acting on the screen, the work of the director and the cinematographer and the editor to highlight the importance of people's body language and lighting and overall atmosphere in order to be able to tell a story without words. Mm. And obviously, the reason this scene works well for me is not just because Alex has a broad cinematic lexicon. I would still have to have watched some of those same movies in order to get the full effect. But there is still talent at work here, where he is able to take a limited medium and able to help me visualize exactly what this scene might look like if it played out on screen. Visualization can be a stumbling block for me. I need help in that regard, which is a bit why I have moved away from books and more towards other media over the years. This is a reason why tropes can be good, because they are patterns we recognize, even when a creator is using them only to subvert them.
I think that what Alex uses in this scene, and it makes me believe, based on what we know of his predilection for color theory, is he emphasizes the color in this moment by having Abigail say that the thing that she noticed was that her mother was wearing, I think, a sort of more striking shade of lipstick and her fine dress and everything about it, which she says she realizes in retrospect she deliberately did this to create a more striking visual to help Abigail remember her more clearly, and says bless her for her forward thinking on that. And having the characters sort of relaying this sense of what effect they experience for taking in the visuals around them, it just completely predisposes you to try to imagine what it is they're seeing and how it has this effect on them, and so it will have its own effect on you. And all I could imagine when Abigail was describing this moment where she is trying desperately to kind of capture everything into a mental photograph so that she can keep it with her for the days ahead, is that everything around her would be in this sepia tone, monochrome color, whereas her parents would be the only ones who really stood out and had depth and detail and that vibrant pop of color that you would imagine would be on display in something like a Del Toro film. Because the scene emphasizes the importance and power of these details and why they leave a lasting effect on Abigail, it just helps you to see it in the same way that she sees the scene. And so it becomes this lasting moment for you as well.
Yeah. When I mentioned my love for this scene to Alex a long time back, one of the influences he pointed me at was a favorite song of his from Elton John called My Father's Gun. Most of my experience with Elton John are either his seriously greatest hits that came up out of the 70s, or a lot more of his big pop hits from the 80s and 90s. So My Father's Gun is a bit of an older take, and I mentioned at the time that it just felt very unusual to hear Elton singing a song about this, particularly when Elton was from Greater London and his long-term songwriter Bernie Taupin was from Lincolnshire, the same county where the Shaws are currently based out of. Definitely not the deep south of America.
A little removed from one another.
Yeah, exactly. So the idea that they would come up with a song that was specifically invoking the Civil War and a young man going off to fight for the Confederate Army to pick up the gun of his father and go off to, you know, find success and glory. The music itself, as Alex expressed, is something that he feels like goes in very well with the overall theme of this particular scene and of the time frame of his story, even though the lyrics very much do not, because having taken a look at them, it's, and in comparison to how Abigail herself feels about the Confederates and the South and the reasons for going to war and all things like that, she would not necessarily be singing this song.
From this day on, I own my father's gun. We dug a shallow grave beneath the sun. I laid his broken body down below the southern land. It wouldn't do to bury him. Yankee stands.
You know, the overall impression that Alex gave me was that she would at least very much enjoy certain elements of the song, and the music in particular, even if she didn't agree with the lyrics or some of the sentiments that the song champions. But it's Elton John. There's no such thing as a bad Elton John piece of music, unless you...
No argument for me on that.
unless you're looking at the stuff that he started getting into when he was... completely coked up and on the outs with Port Burney. But yeah, it's, you know, I'm a huge fan of Elton John, so I, when Alex brought this up, I definitely wanted to listen to it, and I can definitely still appreciate the talent and the overall feelings that are trying to be conveyed and the world that's trying to be conveyed, even if some of the lyrics get under my skin.
Yeah.
So that's another thing we'll post a link to once this goes up online.
And it does, it calls to mind what we were talking about way back at the beginning of this podcast, was when we were talking about the poem that starts off this book. This scene being inspired by a song which was written by, you know, two UK lads who were inspired by stories of this setting, this period, and all of that. It makes me think of how that opening poem is about, like, its inclusion is showing this author who's very well known and has his own distinctive style, but he's writing a poem which is inspired by another person, and it's this layering of influences which all build off one another and kind of inspire and someone else to kind of take it and twist it into something new and have its own voice, is very much, I think, another part of what makes New Century so imaginatively cinematic. I think what I mean by that is the sense that when you read New Century or listen to New Century, you almost always feel like you're watching it play out, even if you're experiencing it through a medium other than film. It always feels like it is drawing from a wealth of influences that feels like, even though it's telling this new story, it draws from stories which have this power to repeat and be shared. And I think that that's the power of these influences that create these scenes.
What we are discussing here isn't something unusual. It's literally the progression of humanity itself. Ideally, we always learn from those that came before and use that as a stepping-off point to try new things. It's also an oft-repeated axiom that no new stories can be told, which is itself a variation on a quote by Mark Twain. We take a lot of old ideas and put them into a mental kaleidoscope, making new combinations of the same components used throughout the ages. That doesn't mean you can't take those pieces and make something compelling. Sometimes a great piece of art is just a familiar story done exceptionally well. That's why things like genres and tropes even exist. They are the patterns we are recombining in different ways. And the best creators look at many examples of stories done well and stories done badly, so they can best figure out what combinations result in a story worth retelling. Most of all, sometimes that story needs to be retold. Humans forget. We all need mirrors to remind ourselves who we are. Stories help us feel, teach us empathy, give us perspective and hope. Stories tell us things that were, things that are, and sometimes even things that have not yet come to pass, but very well could if we are not prepared. Those are the best kinds of stories, the ones that teach instead of merely entertain. And that's why Toby and I champion New Century. All right, it feels like we've been talking for a million years at this point. We still have a couple of things that I want to get to before we wrap everything up. One of the questions I had goes back to the Catherine Holloway speech that I inserted earlier, specifically the way that it ends. When I first reread this, I didn't understand exactly what she meant by the words she uses about how we are the ones that were loved. Having had some more time to think about it, what does that line mean to you?
Because Catherine is the one who is providing this space for the children to survive in, and the fact that, she is saying that you are here because you were loved. They were sent here by their parents so that they could survive, even though they knew that the same opportunity wouldn't be afforded to them. That is a gesture of love, and there's no two ways about it. Even someone as horrible as Doris Cooper, she is there because her family wanted her to be safe, and as noxious as her family appear to be, she is still there because she is loved. And so it, what she says rings very true to them. And so it's interesting for her to include herself in her speech, to say, we are here because we were loved, because it suggests that if Catherine wasn't also loved, then she wouldn't be able to be in this environment, this safe place, and be able to share it with others. And, you know, if you trace it back far enough, that would be true, that she was able to be raised and marry someone and then get to a stable enough position because of the number of people who supported her throughout her life. So there is that. I think that the important thing here, for at least for her intention when speaking to these children, is that she wants them, at a moment where they don't know anyone here, and this is going to be very important for first impressions, for them to feel secure, it's important that for as much as she is presenting herself as the person in authority here, the person who is a stable presence to help them feel secure, she wants to, at the very least on this particular matter, reassure them that she is with them, in that she understands the thing that they all understand, which is love, and that she knows that they are going to be missing that more than anything else right now. So to kind of present enough of herself that she is this sort of iron fortress for them to feel safe in, but to make sure that the one thing that she says, that I am like you in this regard, is that we have all been loved, is probably one of the most reassuring things she could say to these children who are uncertain, and it's something for them to hold on to. As she mentions, she needs them to remember these things, and the best way she can sort of hope to achieve that is by revealing this aspect of herself, that she acknowledges that she is as strong as she is, and in a position of as much security as she is, because of everything that the people who loved her provided to her across the whole span of her life.
Yeah. I thinking about it, honestly, as the one thing that I unfortunately remember the fewest details about were some of the emotional beats of the Cartographer's Handbook. We learn about Catherine as this story progresses, but her specific story is only vaguely referred to, because as we get into Chapter 6, it's being recorded to go into the Cartographer's Handbook, so we don't actually hear her talk about her experience that led her to this place, to Weirwood, until that book. And so therefore this conversation, that's going to come back to us when we finally get into that story. So make a note when we get to her story talking about Weirwood to hearken back to this part of Secret Rooms. At time of recording, I did not know or had forgotten that in the original published version of Secret Rooms, the tale of Weirwood was included in Chapter 1. So while we will still likely save discussion of that story for our retrospective on the Cartographer's Handbook, we will discuss the various differences between the two published works, and this will be one of them. Okay, two more things left. Over the course of Chapter 4, Alex kind of gives the game away a little bit by having this one moment where Lucy, one of the new characters that we meet along the way, is voicing the overall values, the core values of New Century, by having her comfort Abigail's little sister, which, if you listen to the audio version of this, is portrayed quite excellently by Alex's own daughter, Lyra. It's a particularly emotional scene thanks to all the voice acting at play. Sharon, Theo, Lyra, and the lilting melody that Alex uses to underscore Lucy's message of hope, but also just her supreme empathy to help a terrified child that is overwhelmed by the state of things. Right now, in our current state of affairs, we need Lucy's words. Every year, month, week, and day, we also feel like things are getting more broken. Earlier today, Toby and I got some further bucking up from another of the voices of hope from New Century. Not to get ahead of ourselves, but those of you who know Annie Oakley as voiced by Loretta Sela understand what I'm talking about. And to those of you that don't, you'll meet one of the finest characters this series has to offer soon enough. But I'm definitely looking forward to sharing the message she gave to us in a future episode of White Scarves Team Up. For now, let me give it back to my co-host. After listening to our original conversation, he decided to take another swing at explaining his own emotional response to this scene, and I think that you'll agree that he succeeds.
Abigail's sister, Joanna, speaks of a sense of the overwhelming. Here it applies to world weariness and that German word for world sad, Weltschmerz, a term that was coined by the German author John Paul. And that is so understandable, particularly in the year 2020. There's so much you see every day in every system, in every part of the world, on every level that just, you know, needs improving, needs salvaging, uprooting, needs a whole number of things that I can't even list here. There's so much, too much, that our heart wants to do for the world, but simply can't. And sometimes on a much more personal scale, the weight of all that we want to do or know that we need to do for ourselves and the small world around us, even that can feel like too much. That's what that sentiment speaks to as well, that is expressed here with Joanna. There's a world of things I know I need to work on, and so many debts I owe to people who are truly special to me and I know are hurting in their own ways. And there are days when wanting to do all that but feeling powerless and feeling that it's impossible to do so with what I am capable of, that will get to me and I'll just go numb or passive or collapse and just let the tears come. And Lyra's performance as Joanna here gives voice to that, and it's heartbreaking. And what Lucy says in response to this isn't a solution. She doesn't say it is, but it is something small, achievable, and helpful. And it's that little glimpse of hope in the darkness that I not only like to hold on to, I need it. There are a few hopeful speeches in stories, media, or simply in life which get to me like this, or have as much applicability on a day-to-day basis as this. So I owe this moment to New Century a lot.
This idea that Toby highlights in Lucy's message to Joanna, which is also Alex's message to us, is so fundamental to getting through the day, even when all you are dealing with is your own anxiety or depression. It's frequently present in messages people send to their social media followers, reminding everyone to do basic things like eat, sleep, take meds, drink water, and all the little things that can pile up and make a fragile situation worse if we avoid doing them. Obviously, it's bigger than that for Joanna and all of us living in certain parts of the world right now. But sometimes managing the small things makes us feel better enough to make progress elsewhere. And if we can't manage to do those small things, then tackling the larger things feels that much more impossible. What we're all saying is, do the best you can on the small scale. And hopefully, that will be enough to build on, so that everyone can finally start to chip away at the larger problems again. I came up with a phrase during therapy. When dealing with a problem, use all the tools in your toolbox, in whatever combination works, even if it's just to get through the next day, the next hour, the next minute. Between School of Movies and New Century, the Shaws and their cadre of friends, contemporaries, and fans have given us more tools to work with. Their words, their laughter, their anger, their vulnerability. Their insistence on being true to who they are, even when it hurts sometimes. Me and Toby are just following their example, and trying to amplify something that has been useful for us. Even if it's just a reminder to you about things you already know, but may have forgotten thanks to your own world weariness. So, once again, we have managed to end an episode, or half an episode, really, on a heavy topic. In this case, I hope it's an ending that is overall more hopeful than the last. It occurs to me only after the edit that we skipped over talking about any significant events in Chapter 5, which is almost a shame, considering that after I edited down the repetitive ramble that Toby and I got into during our original conversation, this half-episode has actually ended up pretty short. Don't worry, we will discuss in detail some of the stuff that Chapter 5 gets into in regards to the developing relationship between James, Abigail, and Lucy, but that really needs more context first anyway. As far as what happens next on the docket, the next retrospective episode on Secret Rooms will involve Chapters 6 through 9, which is the first half of Part 2, Setting Out. I already know that that episode also clocks in at around 2 hours, and after the emotional stress of editing this episode, I'm not sure yet if I want to dive right back in, even if overall the topic list is less weighty. Right now, my plan is thus. Next week, you will get to enjoy part one of a new White Scarves team-up, where Toby and I interview one of the voice actors, Thea Lee. And in 2 weeks, the next installment of Secret Rooms will come out. To round out episode 7, I'm going to play for you a Sarah Bareilles song that has special resonance with the events of these episodes. The story begins with James, titled The Lonely Boy in the chapter heading, but the song applies just as much to Joanna Gray, and the singer could very well be reflective of Catherine Holloway, singing about the love and support these young people need in a difficult world. And after the song, you'll get to hear a number of hilarious outtakes that I managed to collect just over the course of editing the last two half-episodes. Playing us out till the next trip through the wind door, this is Satellite Call. Take care.
One's for the lonely child.
feel like the most important ones, at least in terms of the development of James and alligator? No.
Alligator, sure.
Oh, good. Alligator. Just not in the same
level. Why, Greg? How could our listeners possibly know that a wind door is involved in this series?
The world may never know. But it's not something that's covered in these first five chapters, so let us continue on.
It's about a raven and a deerstalker.
Okay, all of a sudden to be like, now we're getting into, what is it, the great mouse detective concept here, and starting to turn talking animals into detectives and all the like.
Would that be so wrong?
No, I'm there for it.
All right, tune in, listeners. A project coming soon for me is the continuation and cinematic universe of The Great Mouse Detective. It will be shut down by Disney immediately.
I don't know, the way that they're remaking everything, for all we know, we're going to get a live-action version of the
It won't be live-action, it'll be a photorealistic animation!
I was wondering if you were going to jump in with that. Okay. At time of recording, I did not know or had forgotten that in the original published version of Secret Rooms, the tale of Wheelwood...
Well, that's our show.
Hope you had as much fun as we did.
We're touched so you be touched.
Good night, everybody.